George Station over. No basis where they're charged at all. We're in effect slandering. I think they're in there.
And is it contaminated?
Huh? Well, I think it's a question, no, I think it's a question whether, certainly I think it's a question in my mind whether the guy ought to be convicted of murder versus manslaughter.
Well, here's the problem that I see in this, that this allows the person who has the ability, because of his circumstances, whatever they are, to rationalize to himself that he is justified in committing cold-blooded murder to be reduced to manslaughter. And that person, I mean, you talk about the, they talk about the murders not being recidivist and this type of thing, which is generally true. But that person, who because of his circumstances, can rationalize the extent that he's justified doing it, that's a type, if there is a type, that's liable to do it again.
Of course.
Good. When I was in Eugene, in juvenile court there, we had a 15-year-old boy that shot his mother. And the test on him, he was not insane under the, if not in the field, but probably would not even under this new test be insane, that he had the ability to justify to himself that he was perfectly justified in feeling no remorse in killing
food.
And whenever anybody attempted to assert control over him that he felt was wrong, they felt that he was extremely intelligent kid, and that throughout
sick,
the rest of his life, he
really
probably would be able to rationalize to himself that he was entitled to do this, to take another person's life. And he is extremely dangerous.
Were you better off convicting a man like that of murder? You still don't. If you get this kind of a person who's on a sort of a liner and the jury feels sorry enough for him to reduce the conviction from murder to manslaughter, remember that the court still has some large sentencing control over that.
Well, theoretically, the jury's verdict isn't supposed to be based on sympathy or prejudice or passion. It's based on the facts.
Is it material to consider whether or not the victim, one who died, had any knowledge of the character or the weaknesses or the idiosyncrasies of the defendant?
I don't believe it is. I don't think it's relevant to this defense.
Well, what? No, I don't mean to this defense, but you're talking now about the defendant being able to show his entire background and to show why he reacted in the particular manner he did in the circumstances that existed. Now, at that point, is it important or is it relevant to consider whether or not the victim, the deceased, who perhaps aggravated him, was aware of that he was anything other than a reasonable man?
Well, I don't think so, Senator. I don't think that that
difference between criminal and civil philosophy.
I don't want to be in a position of upholding what essentially is the kind of person that I don't like either. I don't like a man, one who commits manslaughter any more than the rest of us here. And I want to emphasize that I'm not taking the part of the poor downtrodden defendant. I'm trying to do what I think this commission has done all along, and that is to raise the sights of the criminal law in Oregon to look at subjectivity, not entirely, but much more so than the law of Oregon and the United States has in the past. This is reflected not only in the work you've already done here, but it's reflected in every new modern code and in the model penal code, certainly.
Judge Burns.
I'm sorry I was out for a few minutes, but this not hypothetical, but the case that George mentioned of the factory worker, do I understand you to say that under present Oregon law, that would not go to the jury as a possible manslaughter case?
Well, I don't think it would.
By the court's instruction?
Well, not by court instruction.
Well, wait a minute.
I get the evidence. I think it was being proper for the court
to let it. Don't they have to instruct on
that? Not on the concept of this section.
No, the...
Well, but the point I make is that I thought I understood him to suggest that under present Oregon practice, you wouldn't submit a manslaughter verdict.
No, I don't know. I didn't throw in that
hat. No.
But the court wouldn't, under the present practice, tell him if there's a reasonable explanation for his act, then it's manslaughter and not murder.
Well, I'm impressed with what Don says in the, where we have diminished responsibility, which presumably, if we take away the distinction between first and second degree murder, then presumably the usefulness and the applicability of diminished responsibility will be possible reduction from murder to manslaughter. It won't affect between first and second because we won't have it. I'm somewhat impressed as long as you have that.
For what it's worth, I point out that the Model Penal Code retains both diminished responsibility as a defense and this defense with respect to murder and manslaughter. And I think there is a substantial question with respect to mental disease or defect, whether that applies in one case or another.
Is there any overlapping, do you feel, between this section and the diminished responsibility?
I have no doubt that there'd be an individual that would call it across a mental disease or defect situation that might avail himself of this one just as successfully or as unsuccessfully.
Well, he tried both.
What about the individual who wants to sleep with the cocktail waitress and she refuses him, and he becomes so emotionally disturbed by virtue of that refusal that he kills her?
Because his background has been such he's never been refused before.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand first refusal or all that. Second refusal.
But I would expect and hope that many juries would say that is not a reasonable explanation. I never underestimate the resourcefulness of defense counsel, and we know from here how resourceful they can be.
At the same time, you have that jury there to make that ultimate decision, whether it was reasonable explanation or excuse.
Well, I one time prosecuted a guy a long time ago that came home in the middle of the night when he wasn't expected to and found an Indian in bed with his wife. And he didn't disturb them. He quietly went away and went down and got himself real good and drunk and went and got his rifle and came back and shot the Indian about 2 hours later. And he claimed that was a reasonable thing according to the common law of the land, that whenever you find somebody in bed with your wife, you can shoot them. Was a virtual argument.
Especially if it's an Indian.
Especially if it's an Indian. And
No, it's passing the buck.
The jury was out a long time arguing between first and second degree on that, and finally convicting him of second degree. But he would have had a pretty good argument under this thing, but he did anyway.
But he actually had the same argument, didn't he?
Yeah, he had the same argument. Well,
and the same evidence.
Mm-hmm. He argued that it was an irresistible passion, didn't he? Essentially.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
What's created to find that one? We had quite a round.
It seems that I have a hard time deciding whether there's a difference between an extreme mental disturbance or how do we define insanity, a mental disease or defect, as a mental defect.
This doesn't go to that extent, though. It could, but it doesn't necessarily.
Well, I'm just looking at it from a juror's standpoint. Here's all these instructions on one side. So the guy doesn't raise the insanity defense. He doesn't want to tip the prosecution off that he's going to do it, so he comes in and starting the day of the trial, he claims that he was under the influence of an extreme emotional or mental disturbance, not a defect. And
State hasn't had
its chance to do any psychiatric examination. It would seem that
case of a good defense attorney, that this would be a pretty useful tool to work out, if you present enough evidence on the thing, enough statements by the defendant to this extent, the judge instructs on manslaughter under this section, that the jury would be pretty well bound. I know there's the preponderance of the evidence ain't supposed to weigh in their deliberations, but it does.
Well, now, wait a minute.
What do you mean, preponderance of the evidence?
Well, if they hear enough on this subject and enough on manslaughter, they're going to
solve
back
that problem,
as
the reporter suggested here, by putting a notice provision in, if they introduce any psychiatric test.
But, Bob, on the other hand, what this would do, if the jury would make that determination anyway, there wouldn't be any expert evidence with respect to mental disease or defect on either side.
Under this?
No. Under this,
the
there
way
wouldn't.
We have it now.
Yeah. And the jury would make that determination. The only possible thing that could be affected is the admissibility of certain evidence pertaining to this defense. Isn't that right, George?
Which it seems to me you get in anyway, but you get it in under some...
But you don't get the instruction.
You're not really guaranteed that you'll get it in either.
Well, I don't think the instruction's going to make that much difference. I mean, the jury's...
Boy, if a good defense attorney is going to argue instructions...
Too bad, yeah.
What's going to be the instruction under this?
You are... things that the law requires if they do something.
You are instructed that if you find that the defendant acted from extreme mental or emotional disturbance for which you find a reasonable explanation or excuse, then he will not have committed murder. Then you are instructed to return a verdict of manslaughter.
Well, what's wrong with that?
But it's not from the standpoint, it doesn't just have to be a reasonable explanation or excuse. It's a reasonable explanation or excuse in the standpoint of the defendant.
Yeah.
And what's wrong with that is that every crime is being a subject, or we're imposing a subjective test on it. And I think you could find almost every instance of homicide, impose that objective test and come up with manslaughter rather than murder.
Well, that's why I say you're opening up the door, but we have to decide whether we want to.
I agree, John. We're getting towards subjectivity, but I would not agree that it's a pure subjective test. As long as we're using that word reasonable, it inserts basically and ultimately an objective term in the deliberation of the jury or whoever the fact.
Well,
may I ask this question? What is the difference between a reasonable explanation to me in a given set of circumstances and
a reasonable proven man?
And a reasonable belief in my mind under the same circumstances acting as a reasonable prudent person? Is there a difference between those two standards?
Well,
yes, there's a big difference, as I understand it. Under this, the question of whether or not it is reasonable is in light of his background, his understanding, his views, and his feelings, then is it a reasonable explanation?
As a practical matter, it isn't that much of a difference, because the jury isn't going to believe, you take the Hansen case that you mentioned, the jury isn't going to believe the defendant that the refusal by the cocktail waitress was in his mind a reasonable reason to take off on. I think in the end, the jury still applies the pretty close to the prudent man test. I think there have been...
Suppose, though...
The way you're going to get around it is the jury just isn't going to believe this.
Suppose a situation where a defendant, his counsel leads him all through his childhood, and he reacts differently, he looks, appraises things differently than the ordinary, normal individual, and this hasn't been contradicted by the prosecution in any way, and certainly in that situation, in light of his background, it is a reasonable explanation or excuse to him, and the state hasn't refuted that in any way, and the jury returns a verdict of manslaughter. You say the jury is going to have the ultimate determination. They do, But that case would be reversed by the Supreme Court under this.
And he can argue that it, to him, with his background, it is a reasonable explanation.
Yes.
Maybe not an excuse, but
an explanation.
Says,
yeah.
Kevin, does the jury doesn't have to believe his testimony?
Well, if there isn't any other testimony, they sure as hell have to.
Any more so? You just got through, in the last section, adopting a highly subjective defense in an area where it had been purely objective before, felony murder. We don't care anything about what that particular actor thought, as long as death flowed from the particular activity. Now we're saying, we will look at what you thought, and what you intended, and what you did. And will allow you a very limited defense on that grounds. Now, that didn't offend anyone, and still, that subjective application it differs only in the number of cases that it's going to arise in.
Yeah, but George, I told you you got by too easy in the last section.
I'd rather lose the argument all the way around than to have you take what I think are inconsistent positions with respect to culpability of defendants.
Well, under your homicide, though, and your felony murder, there, we've cast that in terms of an affirmative defense, and we've established six specific things that this defendant is going to have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence to get himself out of felony murder. I think that's a big distinction between that section and this section. Here, this isn't cast in terms of a defense.
Well, you can do
this. This is cast really in terms of an exception to murder.
If that's all that's holding you back, you can certainly make it an affirmative defense.
Plus, there isn't really anything to guide you as to what kind of junk he can bring in.
now we're getting down to the intellectual argument.
Take this out, Connie,
and legalizing what presently does.
Yeah, sure.
Very wide latitude on background of the defendant when he takes the stand anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but you're not going to find very many defendants taking the stand now and say, I killed this guy, and I did it, and I'm glad because I was mad at him. And he insulted me, and I got mad, and I stayed mad the more I thought about the matter I got. You're not going to find that kind of a case.
Sure you are.
That's essentially a
self-defense case is what it amounts to. Sure is. When you can show the guy shot him, and there's no question about it, the state can prove it. Then what do? You sit back and pray?
Well, you're not going to try to establish self-defense where the guy's thought about it for a week and there's no danger to him or anything. You're not going to get that in under a self-defense theory.
No, I'm making the analogy, however, putting a defendant on the stand and extracting from him.
In his own mind, he's defending himself.
Well, Dave, I had a case about a month ago where these two fellas who did a little bit of drinking, they got in a fight. And one guy pistol whipped my guy with this gun. And then they both went to bed. My guy laid there in bed all night thinking about it. And the more he thought about it, the madder he got. So we waited until his buddy went to sleep, then went in the other room, stood about 4 feet away from the, this is about 6 hours after he got hit with the gun, about 6 feet away from the guy and shot him. And he was just trying to scare him, but he had to get him between the eyes and kill him. Under our present law, that was manslaughter. But under this, I think that you could show a reasonable explanation or excuse. He might lay there in bed and thought about the matter he got.
The more disturbed he got.
George, would it disturb you any more greatly than you're already disturbed?
Don't get me too disturbed.
it would have to be
agitated. Remember, this is not the law yet.
if the language read where there is a reasonable excuse, it took out explanation or.
Well, I changed or to and.
One more question. Were those to those who are opposed to this, apparently, would it help any if we were to make this an affirmative defense and require notice? So the state would have opportunity for...
I'm not necessarily opposed to it.
Yeah.
I think there ought to be notice.
I think it'd be a very clumsy thing to start converting it to an affirmative defense.
Boy, if you have to give notice on this thing, you have to give notice of the fact that he did commit the homicide, don't you?
No.
This isn't like alibi where he said I wasn't there.
Notice will be I'm going to bring in an expert.
Yeah. I meant notice as to experts, Dave.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily need experts.
No, that's right.
No, you wouldn't. It's
funny.
You wouldn't.
Experts, you've got to get notice of
them.
Well, go back to your question. I think it's...
Well, it occurs to me that what everybody is bothered about is that word explanation, and it seems to me that perhaps the middle ground here, either taking the word explanation out or changing the word in, might very well be a solution.
That's perfectly acceptable to me. I think it still leaves intact the basic concept of the defense.
I get the feeling that if you had the word "and" there, that perhaps satisfies some of the doubts that have been expressed here.
I like it's an excuse.
Well, how about changing that "or" to and then deleting the rest of the sentence after the period?
Well, that's when you would still retain the objectivity test.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, I will move to amend sub 2 so as to make read explanation and excuse in both the first and second.
Second. You've heard the motion. Any discussion?
Good.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed no. Carried.
Now I have moved to strike the whole section.
I'll second the motion.
Oh, yeah, the affirmative motion.
Are you talking about subsection 2 or the entire section?
The subsection 2 is section 3.
Motion is made. Motion is made to leave subsection 2 as amended.
Well, I'd like to ask a question. What would you put in there?
Well, I think that then there's got to be something in there on the heat of passion thing as an L path.
As far as I'm concerned.
Discussion?
No.
Less mumbling and further discussion.
Yeah, we get that whip driver up. Yeah, slave driver.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 Opposed no?
No.
The chair is in doubt.
What is the motion?
The motion is to delete subsection 2. Those in favor of the motion will raise their right.
I assume the corollary of your motion.
One, two, three. Those opposed? Motion is defeated.
Not much doubt now.
The motion, we don't require a second under our rule. The motion's been made to adopt subsection 2 as amended. Call a roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sandra Burns?
No.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
No.
Frost?
Aye.
Jernstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
No.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Harry. I guess I can't tell the player that I'm learning anymore.
Harry. How about subsection 3?
Subsection 3, we just voted on.
No,
we didn't. Oh, we have 2 of 3. Yeah, well, I'll wait until we get 2 of 3. I want to go back to 2.
All right, well, go ahead now. We have to come to
our own side.
Well, I don't necessarily want to reconsider, but I think maybe our commentary ought to have some of our thinking. Under this, a fellow guilty of criminal homicide, but is committed intentionally or knowingly, or is committed recklessly under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference. Under that B, could a fellow be convicted of that crime, even though he was, so intoxicated that he could not form an intent to kill? I think he could.
Well, to be indifferent, he has to be competent to form a judgment of, as to difference or indifference, I would say. I'd say he couldn't.
Well, the B type is traditionally you're shooting into a building, dropping a heavy object into a crowded street below, and this type of thing.
But it isn't necessarily limited to that, Jim. It could be recklessly driving an automobile down a busy street because you're drunk.
It could be.
I agree.
You could be driving an automobile recklessly, drunkenly into a parade.
I think that ought to be murder.
And I think
it's encompassed within this definition.
Well, I'm not saying that it shouldn't, but I thought we ought to have some commentary on what we do mean by it.
In those situations, I think you're right.
Under our standard of recklessness, it would seem to me that you'd have to establish that he consciously disregarded a known risk. And he wouldn't be able to show that at the time he was drunk, but he would be consciously disregarding a known risk when he got drunk in the first place.
Yes.
And put himself to, you know, in the position of driving an automobile under those circumstances. I think your conscious disregard would be in the getting
part
drunk.
Of voluntary conduct.
It's a deadly guilty of murder.
In most existing law, but I know
it. It's a hell of a thing to do, but should that be murder?
Well, it's presently second degree murder in the code. And
it isn't murder.
163. By an act imminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind regardless of human life, although without any design to affect the death of any particular individual.
This is close to that.
George, isn't there an inconsistency between this and your argument a moment ago with respect to felony murders? You said that this commission adopted a limited defense when in connection with a felony murder, that the person didn't realize anyone had a gun. He didn't intend any violence to occur or anything. Now, coming back, and we adopted that. Now, coming back to this B of section 2. Yeah, sub B. When that guy takes that first drink, you say that's a voluntary act. But he didn't intend to get so drunk that he'd run his car into a crowd. Now, what's the difference? Why stick him for murder in this case and in the felony murder relieve someone from the crime of murder because he didn't realize that anybody had a gun or any violence was going to occur? He's participating. Isn't there an inconsistency there?
There is, and you're absolutely correct. There is an inconsistency, and it's one that has existed in the law ever since man discovered alcohol, I believe. This is the way the law has traditionally responded to the drunkenness cases, and it is inconsistent. Because when a man gets so drunk, falling down, knee-walking drunk, and he doesn't know what he's doing, he has really no mens rea within the established concepts as we're defining them, or as the law previously defined them. Yet we view that as such serious conduct that we are willing, and the law has been willing, to invent what I think is really an inconsistent concept by saying by taking the first drink you knew that you were liable to get drunk, and that if you knew you were liable to get drunk that all these dangerous things might have flowed from your activity.
Your answer is that it's always been treated that way.
The Model Penal Code says that's the law. We don't think it's consistent, in effect it says this, and yet we think that this is the only practical way that society can react to the situation, and therefore it adopts the policy too.
What would happen in this case where a 250-pound football player gets absolutely blind drunk, stumbles on his own feet, and happens to fall on a little baby? that some woman is leading by the hand down the street and the baby dies.
Well, I think it'd be a jury question, and I can't imagine that a jury would find murder in a situation like that.
Well, wouldn't that be, isn't it reckless? The intoxication having nothing to do with it.
I think the situation is the same under existing law, Senator. I think you have the same difficulty in the way the law now defines murder and manslaughter. And I don't. And you posed a tough situation. You put your finger on a place that's soft in the concept of mens rea. And I don't know what the answer is other than the one I've given you. If there was a better way to do it, I'd sure like to be able
to
do it.
Of course, in that case, it wouldn't manifest an extreme difference in the value of human life.
Yes, it would.
Well, the jury might say that.
Yeah, they could say that.
Sure.
I'd say you'd be hard pressed to charge anything higher than negligent homicide in the case. And I would think that before you could get a conviction under the second degree, even if the drunk ran through a crowd of people, before you could get a conviction under that second degree, you'd have to show that he was not so drunk, but what he could see people up there because his intoxication led him to the point that he just didn't give a damn.
Wouldn't you indict him for second degree?
You know, Professor Perkins, who has written the outstanding text on the criminal law, holds that this is a situation that you're talking about, that there ought not to be any guilt, where a person is so drunk that he has lost touch with ethics and morals of society, that he ought not to be held for his act. And this is one of the views of what the law ought to be. And of course, it probably might take a different tack than from what you personally want it to come out, but that's what he says about it, and he's alone, as far as I know, in the academic world, at least.
Well, Don Clark would agree with him. You weren't here during our drunk discussions. Well, is it understood then that this does apply to the situations that Bruce has described? Is everyone satisfied with Section 2?
Chairman, I'm glad we went back to this section because I had a technical question I wanted to raise earlier.
You're just trying to get even with
me. Oh, no, no, more equal. No, I like Section 2.
What's the technical?
Now, under our assault draft, we have a crime of assault in the first degree where we have some language very, very close to this language that appears in Subsection 1B with respect to circumstances manifesting extreme indifference. Now, but the discussion on assault was we originally had drafted that to read, a person commits a crime of assault in the first degree if he intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes serious physical injury to another under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. We had a great amount of discussion, both in subcommittee and in the commission, about the use of the word extreme. And the upshot of the whole thing was that no one was quite sure what it meant. And so we, much to my dismay, decided that we would use the word gross. And that was voted in. So our assault now reads gross indifference to the value of human life. And I think since these tests should be pretty much the same, that we should be consistent in either using extreme in both places or gross in both places.
I like that gross. It sounds awful, just awful.
Well, I think it would be a mistake to use that word because it comes with baggage.
Gross.
It comes with all kinds of existing definitions in Oregon cases, both in the civil and the criminal field. And I think that the existing law with respect to gross is contrary, generally, to our definitions. Now, we use the word gross in the levels of culpability definition. I think that appears here and there. But in the context of those definitions, it is clearly not the way that it's been defined in existing cases. And I'd like to see us use a word that doesn't always always change with it.
Well, should we change...
Of course, I agree with Don that it would be a real mistake to have two different words.
I do too.
Because all it's going to do is confuse somebody later on.
You know, after time goes by, we look differently on these things when we're farther removed from the immediate heated discussion. Is there any objection to changing the word gross to extreme in the assault article? If there is no objection, it'll be so ordered. Now, are we...
ready to come to sub-3 manslaughter?
Well, I refer to this passage in the original discussion, and I point out
that, Mr. Chairman, that's what's known as lying in wait.
Yes, it is.
Subsection 3 of the section defines as manslaughter, intentional causing or aiding another to commit suicide. All cases of intentionally causing or aiding a suicide are prosecutable as manslaughter under this provision, and I think that reflects the existing Oregon law. But as noted in the commentary to Section 2 previously, these cases in which duress or deception is used by the defendant are also prosecutable as murder. I think this reflects current law.
Yeah. That's one of those little dandies, Bob. Discussion? Frank Knight?
I would think that at least in fairness, that under paragraph 2 of section 3, that if and when the defendant is going to call expert testimony, at least, that the state should have an opportunity, should be given notice and have the same opportunity that they have under the insanity defense to examine the defendant.
I agree with that.
Only the expert testimony will be called.
Well, yeah.
We have existing language, which I
mean. Isn't there language like that in the diminished responsibility article?
Yeah. We had it here a moment ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, George. I stole it.
Yeah, because we said in diminished responsibility that he has to give notice only where he relies on the testimony.
The section says, the defendant may not introduce in his case in chief expert testimony regarding partial responsibility under section 2 of this article, unless he gives notice of his intent to do so in the manner provided in section 6 of this article. Now we'd have to make some adjustments.
Did I say use the word expert testimony?
Yeah. Yes. That decision was made, which means, and consciously, it was decided by the counsel of commission to mean that if he brings his own, if he himself testifies, or if his wife or his friends testified, that he need not give notice.
But that if he calls on an expert,
but if he brings in a psychiatrist or a psychologist, he's got to give notice.
I so move.
I go on, my young man.
Now, does a partial responsibility also appear with the direct within of the state to have the defendant examined when he gives his notice?
I don't think so. No.
Well, it's all right to open the door and leave it wide open. Let's at least leave a door there that could possibly.
I'm sure it doesn't have to be closed.
Now we know what he means by fairness.
Yeah, upon the filing of notice or the introduction of evidence by the defendant as provided in Section 6, and that includes the partial responsibility notice also, the state has a right to that.
Did you do that? What? Lee Johnson?
Oh, I know.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we add appropriate names to Section 3 or elsewhere in this article so as to equate it with partial responsibility for the giving notice and right to examine on behalf of the state.
Only if expert testimony will be
there. Yes, in Section 6.
You've heard the motion.
I'll second that.
All in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Now, Frank, that was a little bit lying in wait, too.
Well, we all want to be fair, Mr. Chairman. That was
I mean, now that we've opened this door.
I move we adopt Section 3 as amended.
You've heard the motion. Call the roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sammy Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Section 3.
Chandler?
Aye.
Carr? Ross?
Aye.
Jernstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
No.
Spalding?
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Mr.
Chairman. Aye. I don't recall that subsection 1 is being added. Yeah, either.
He moves an amendment and passes, then he votes against it.
No. Well, let's wait until we get through with Paul.
That whole deal of Section 2.
Well, we're not talking about Section 2.
Oh, yes, we are.
No, I mean subsection 1 of Section 3.
Well, we adopted the whole thing as amended, George, right now. That was the vote.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Section 4. At night, gets everything he wants, and then votes no.
He wants his record cleared.
So I won one vote, said the whole thing, after voting no four or five times on this thing. You expect me to just turn around and...
You should have had Clark here a little earlier.
On Section 4, do we define criminal negligence?
Yes, but not in this article.
He's got lying in which section?
I think I said it out here. A person acts with criminal negligence. This is what the commission's definition of it is. Person acts with criminal negligence or is criminally negligent with respect to attendant circumstances or the result of his conduct when he should be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the circumstances exist or that his conduct will cause the result that his failure to be aware of the risk constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in this situation.
That's a real fancy definition.
That's the model penal code definition, essentially.
We've got a lot of decisions now on the medical homicide where the courts adopt the civil definition of negligence, gross negligence, and put it on the criminal statute.
That's because the negligent homicide statute says gross negligence.
Yes, and I think we're obviating that now.
Now that we're getting rid of it, we're going through the code.
Criminal negligence statute being not really any more than...
It's okay in this definition.
And in the present statute. Is the definition. In the present law. No, just criminal negligence.
Oh, yeah.
State versus Hodgson... in recent decisions on this problem, equates gross negligence under the negligent homicide statute, or as 163.091, with recklessness. And I think that the latest decision in that line probably makes that present view of the Oregon court in different language, but the same degree of liability that we're defining now, because I believe that the result here would be correspond with what the court was getting at there.
Yeah, well, the reason for my question was to reach back and make some use of all those decisions on gross negligence.
Well, I'd rather not. They're in conflict, and I'm confused.
It's like the passenger of gross negligence. It's defined every time it comes up.
Well, you're going to have to define this all starting all over again.
Yeah, but there's some advantage, I think, to that, Bruce. Starting all over again. You're not dragging through the...
What? May I ask you?
That's all.
May I ask you this question? What set of circumstances would fall within this language and wouldn't perhaps fall within the present language? Would you have
present language of what? Negative homicide?
Yes, negative homicide.
It falls under the automobile homicide.
Big pardon?
That statute applies only to automobile homicide.
Yeah, but we have a lot of definitions of gross negligence that don't apply to automobiles.
This is our present involuntary manslaughter.
As a practical matter, this is
this is a combination.
This is the new caution circumspection involuntary manslaughter now.
This isn't exactly the same thing as our Oregon auto homicide statute.
How about our airplane pilot?
This will treat any automobile homicide which is felt by the jury to be criminally negligent will be a felony now, and can only be treated as a felony. And the code very carefully takes that position by saying that if in fact, viewing the activity of the driver, we find that what he did was criminally negligent, then it's too serious a matter to treat as a misdemeanor. And we ought not to allow juries to treat it as a misdemeanor. If in fact, the prosecution or the state wants it treated as a misdemeanor, then it should select a reckless conduct or a reckless driving charge and not bring a homicide charge at all. But this is a lesser degree now of homicide. The penalty is not going to be as near as severe as the manslaughter penalty would presently be for a manslaughter charge arising out of an automobile accident. And that's what, you know, has triggered the automobile homicide statutes all over the country, because manslaughter carries such a severe penalty.
Well, I take it from what you said that some automobile cases,
any of the folks back from,
could fit into this language.
That's right.
Of course, if the circumstances were such
I totally took up my friend and said, what's the Martini?
Now, what are the standards that, let us say, a prosecutor would be able to look to in determining whether to charge an auto death under this section or under some other section?
Well, he couldn't charge it. What, you mean another homicide section?
Yeah, will he charge manslaughter?
I don't know. I'd have to know what the situation was.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is this. As I understand the president's situation, most auto death cases where there's a prosecution are brought under the special statute rather than the general manslaughter statute, because number one, it's felt that juries are reluctant to convict in auto death cases where you have got a 15-year sentence. And number two, the standard of proof required is a good deal greater in the manslaughter than in the auto death and the homicide. Now, it looks to me that from this draft, we are going to end up so that if you seek to prosecute criminally an auto death case, you have to do it under here or not at all. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. You could do it under manslaughter or presumably under the murder section. If it's the extreme kind of recklessness with extreme indifference to life.
Or if
that's true now.
If it's committed.
The gravity of heart doctrine in the second degree murder, and it's unusual, and I would expect it to be done one time out of a million.
Well, if it's committed recklessly, it would be manslaughter under 3-1.
I suspect that the prosecutor would charge manslaughter.
Well, I thought there was something
lesser included with criminal negligence, or no conviction at all for the homicide.
I thought there was some case law that since we passed our negligent homicide statute that preempted the manslaughter statute.
It does by legislation.
It doesn't now.
It doesn't. It still says that if you've got drunk driving, you probably could, because that's an unlawful act, something you could still go on.
You mean the misdemeanor manslaughter?
Brought that way. Actually, as far as the degree of proof required under gross negligence and the caution and circumspection, under degree of proof, it'd be easier under the manslaughter than under the negligent homicide.
Suppose you got a case, George, where the fellow runs a red light, and as a result of that, he hits another car and causes an auto death.
And he's sober.
And he's sober, yeah. Not drunk. Now, does that make a jury question on manslaughter, recklessly committing a homicide?
No, but it might make a jury question, I believe, on criminal negligence.
I doubt that you can even get to the jury.
When with criminal negligence?
I think it...
read that definition of criminal negligence.
For sure. Okay. It appears in the summary.
It's set out in
a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would exercise in the situation. I don't think that running a red light would rise to the dignity of a gross deviation.
I don't think so either. In the facts stated, Jim doesn't make a very aggravated case, and I don't think it ought to be treated as a felony homicide. It probably ought to be treated as reckless driving, perhaps, or a lesser conduct offense. But I think this is up to the prosecutor. He's going to know. He's going to know the existing circumstances. This fellow is an upright member of the community, and it just happened. As it does happen, I went to a stop sign last week myself. It happened.
Yeah.
I got caught too.
I think I'd agree.
You mean you got caught with
my case
and reduced
my crime by one-third? I
thought
that was pretty good.
That limits it.
But now, under negligent homicide, that wouldn't be a case either, under our present statute.
Well,
if all he was doing was going through a red light. So there's no, you haven't changed it in that sense.
Well, may I simply call your attention to this? Recklessly in the culpability statute says, a person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. Criminal negligence is that a person fails to be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or the circumstance exists. Now, if the man runs the red light
over here, we use criminal negligence. Two separate.
Could you not create a jury question that he was aware of? That he's not drunk, but he was aware of the light, and that he consciously disregarded it.
And he was aware of the risk.
Yeah. And all the rest of it is the same. One he is aware and consciously disregards, and the other he fails to be aware.
Well, is our definition of criminal negligence different than what George has here in this summary?
It's a little different, I think.
Because the definition that he has in this summary,
I just read it.
Criminal negligence, at least, but we now have gross
negligence. Well, we better change it if it's different.
I apologize.
Well, it says the risk must be of such nature and degree that the failure to be aware of it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person
would occur. That's true in both sections.
Well, I think what we're doing is we're talking about the very thing that meant to be talked about. There's got to be some flexibility with respect to what the difference between manslaughter and criminal negligence or no criminal homicide at all. And I think that these definitions that the Commission has already adopted and that are now applied in the homicide statutes perform the function of allowing the kind of debate that we need before the jury and the kind of consideration the jury needs in deciding whether the homicide is criminal or not. There's got to be some play, some give in these kind of definitions. And I think these definitions make a lot more sense than the present mass confusion, not only in Oregon, but all the way through the country, on what negligence is in the civil or criminal sense.
You mean the definitions that Don has in the culpability section, or those definitions, right?
Yeah, those are the ones that I think solve a lot of these problems and still leave questions open that we aren't going to answer here, and I don't think we can, as hard as we try.
Well, I don't understand what you're concerned with. Well, my concern is this. Presently, though I think they're monstrosities, but presently we do have some notion of what gross negligence means by the carving out of these cases, assuming you can understand those cases. Now, this draft would say to us that it is manslaughter if he kills recklessly. And it is
gross deviation.
It is criminally negligent homicide if he kills negligently, criminally negligently. And recklessly says he is aware of and consciously disregards a risk and so forth.
Which is a substantial deviation
and
so on.
Yeah, and so
whole,
on. And,
got
and
to
then
the whole bit.
Yeah, but and then criminally negligent says he fails to be aware of a risk and
but
so on.
Be.
And then from then on, it's exactly the same language. So, if I'm not mistaken, this might very well result in, if I run a red light and am sober, it is manslaughter. Because I think you could get the jury that I was aware of and consciously disregarded.
I don't think so.
But is it a substantial deviation? Situation,
gross deviation,
where you can say this running of this stoplight was really something that we can say is reckless. Okay.
It's the difference between advertence and inadvertence.
But
I think we'll get right back to gross negligence.
But if I am drunk and run a red light, I would think it would be more likely that you would say, well, that is criminally negligent because he failed to be aware of a risk and so forth and so on. Again, assuming that a jury concludes that in each instance the risk, it was a gross deviation and so on.
Of course, in that case, the gross part of it would be driving that car while he was drunk.
No, I guess, Jim, I agree that that's probably what the question is going to be, and I think it can be submitted and carved out by necessary case decisions and experience under these sections.
Isn't the district attorney initially going to make that decision and then the jury?
Well, and typically, in tradition, I would say this critically, he will charge the highest degree that he can reasonably put together a case on, not merely from the standpoint of promoting plea.
Well, we were talking about fairness here a little while ago. Is that fair?
Just
the part of the district
night.
Attorneys?
Then he gets real fair and starts to deal with you.
Reduces it. Sure, he has to do it that way in order to be fair.
So the justice somehow will come out.
Sooner or later, justice will be done.
I think maybe what's bothering me, Mr. Chairman, is I think I would feel more comfortable with this language if we had to do in some of the restatements and so on, if we had, say, two or three typical examples of types of conduct which
this would cover,
which would fall within one as opposed to the other. Now, maybe by the very nature of it, you can't lump up such.
Well, I don't know about the automobile cases, but I do have some examples that I've already alluded to with respect to the difference between recklessness with extreme recklessness and criminal homicide. Those examples are set out through here. They don't relate to automobile negligence, however, automobile homicides.
Of course, that's the area.
I'm not sure that I've...
Well, the definition, really, there's any definition which refer to gross negligence make any real sense in it.
Yeah, really, obviously,
it's something less than recklessness.
60 miles an hour on Route 97 between Chenault and Bend is an entirely different
question.
Exceeding the speed limit
it is
60 miles an hour in downtown Eugene. Example of the difference between recklessness with extreme, probably, in downtown Eugene at Christmas time at 60 miles an hour. That could very well be murder by automobile. But if you kill someone in the vast reaches of eastern Oregon, other than sheep, if you can find somebody, exceeding the speed limit by 5 or 10 miles an hour, then the question would certainly not be recklessness with extreme at all. It would be a startled finding of someone in the first place out there. Because
this is the legal women's position, Mr. Chairman.
The Valley and Multnomah County position.
It might be recklessness or it might be criminal homicide, and it would depend, I submit, on the place, the time, and the circumstances. And I don't think we can really carve out in the comment, the kind of without prejudicing the case before we even get going.
Well, nobody has yet answered Judge Burns' question. I think the minute should reflect something about it. Would you intend by this section to permit someone who was drunk and run a red light and kill someone to come within the purview of this criminally negligent and yet someone who was sober to be guilty of manslaughter?
I think he's answered that.
Has he?
Yeah, I think what he said is...
We don't know.
Under the right circumstances, a sober man could be guilty of manslaughter, even
or
second
murder.
Degree.
Or murder.
Even murder. And under other circumstances, you wouldn't...
I don't think we should be concerned with the vehicle of death, whether it's a gun or a knife or an automobile. I think we should be concerned with the activity and the surrounding circumstances. How did the death result? We don't care. I really think we shouldn't care about the automobile because we're creating a felony, certainly. Now, that's the difference. We're creating a felony situation, but it's on the lowest level of grading. It's not near the extreme penalty that the present manslaughter might result in.
But are we really saying, though, that we're leaving
Chairman,
I think we ought to recognize this too, and I think it's good, at least the way I read Section 4, and looking at the Hodgson case, for example, where they try to equate gross negligence with recklessness. Well, you can't really equate that with our definition of recklessness, although it's closer to our recklessness than it is to our criminal negligence as we've defined it. So I think the consequence of this Section 4 would be
that it would be easier in some cases under certain facts to make out a case of negligent homicide, particularly in an automobile situation, than it would under our present criminal and our present negligent homicide statute. I don't think you're going to have to show the degree of negligence or recklessness, or whatever you want to call it, that you have to establish now. But I think, and if I'm right there, I think that's good, because...
Do I understand you to say that you're agreeing with me, Don?
Yes, I am.
You're on the wrong track, George.
Judge Burns, do you, have your doubts been resolved?
Took up a lot of time.
Section 4.
Motion's been made that Section 4 be adopted. Any further discussion? Is there a call for the question?
Yes.
Call roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Senator Burns?
Aye.
But I do so very reluctantly, George. Just to make you feel too good. Call roll.
I didn't hear anything.
Clark?
You said aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Jones?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Wally, how
do
you vote?
Are you? Oh, I have a question. Carrie, question. All right, just one question. Under, I think, Chapter 484, we have the failure to leave name and address at a scene of an accident in which a fatality occurred. That carries 5 years. That's often used as a vehicle by the prosecution in lieu of a negligent homicide statute where the defendant left the scene. Now, and it incidentally carries a bigger penalty, as you know, than does the negligent homicide statute under our present law. Are we going to somehow or other bring that into the criminal code and impose the culpability requirements that we do in the culpability section on that?
Well, we've already done that to a certain extent with a section of the commission with respect to offenses defined outside the criminal code. I give you that in a minute.
But it will, something we've done...
We have applied by reference.
Culpability.
All right. Don, how about drunken driving? Have we, or are we going to do anything with that, this commission?
Insofar as defining the crime and that sort of thing?
No, well, I was thinking that I've had a number of just two, number two or three justices of the peace. Justices of the peace call me. And they're referring to these cases where a person is found on the highway in his car, dead drunk, and the car's stalled. And they would like to have that change instead of driving while under the influence to either while it's under his control or et cetera, or operating. Now, they feel that the term operating, which some states have, covers that situation. I can't see it, but maybe it does. Is this commission going to consider that area?
Planning to get into the traffic code as such, as far as the definitions of the crimes.
All right, that's all I want to ask. Now, we haven't approved Section 1 of this homicide.
Yeah, we did.
No, we didn't.
So the definitions, call the roll on Section 1, and also, together with that, on approving the article as a whole as amended. Call the roll. And you can't split your roll.
Have you heard of it? No, yes.
Judge Burns.
The obstructing governmental administration. Forehead, I mean, Frank Knight, do you want to say
something? Trade your salary.
Roger, you report. You're going to
wait.
Well,
you
know
that I was there. You did plenty of help today. Thank you very much.
As soon as you get out of here, we're going to move to reconsider.
We should be good. Thank you.
times in a row, man.
George, now George showed something pretty cagey there. He started with the definitions and moved through them and got section two done just like that.
They only had two.
I know, but that's...
Not taking anything away from George.
All right, Roger, do you want to start on that?
Yes, I'll begin. I apologize if I seem confused today, but I'm following in a history month. If I fall asleep at the table, I'll wake you up.
Frank and I won't let you do that.
Section 1 on page 2, definitional section, 7 definitions. Most of these definitions apply to only one or most two sections, so I think it would be advantageous to start section 2 and as we come across each definition, come back and take a look at the definition. On page 6. Obstructing governmental administration. A person commits the crime of obstructing governmental administration if he intentionally obstructs, impairs, or hinders the administration of law or other governmental function by means of intimidation, force, physical interference, or obstacle. Subsection 2 carves out two exceptions. This section shall not apply to the obstruction of unlawful governmental action or interference with the making of an arrest. The reason that interference with the making of an arrest is accepted is because we have a particular section on resisting arrest that will cover that area.
Roger, do you plan that obstacle means the same as induce? Induces? As I see it now, you got to intimidate somebody, you got to force them, you got to hold them down so they can't go to the court or whatever it is, or provide some obstacle. If I just say to John Burns, look, why don't you just get out of town today? Is that an obstacle?
No, I think obstacle is used here more in the sense of a physical impediment.
Well, if we go back in later sections, then we say something about inducing people to do things. I realize those are different crimes. But can't you obstruct the administration of government by inducing people to do things?
Yeah, I think some of the commentary we mentioned that there are many other forms of obstructing governmental administration that are covered in the article for domestic perjury, bribery. Now those two type of offenses do include the type of unlawful inducement.
But you got a lesser, and I don't know what we're grading by. I suppose this would be a lesser offense than perjury, bribery.
I think so. Yes.
Suppose that this attorney has got a case that he doesn't think he can convict someone of bribery under. He wants a catch-all kind of the kind our Supreme Court throws out on the type of offense to try on anyway. Would this be the proper place for him to go?
No, I wouldn't think that if you had the elements of bribery, if you felt you couldn't prove that you could prosecute in lieu of bribery under Section 2, because I don't think the means used are the same. Bribery doesn't involve intimidation or physical interference or obstacles.
No, I know.
Well, Roger, the thing that
we're out of our subcommittee, I guess Bob and I shouldn't be asking this question.
Well, yes, you should.
Thanks for answering this, too.
That's right. The only thing that concerns me now, as it concerned me then, was how far down the line we go with hindering or obstructing or impairing the administration of law or other governmental function. Surely if somebody's going to be hindering the Department of Justice or legislator or some such thing as that, fine. But you go down to the local water board and some ad hoc advisory committee to that, that could we stretch it out to apply to that? I guess we could under our definitions, couldn't we?
Well, on page 10 of the commentary, there's a list of various types of conduct that are considered to be covered under typical obstructing statutes. Both verbal conduct and physical acts.
That's hindering. That's hindering. Yeah, but where does it stop? What level of government? It goes right to the lowest possible.
Well, I see what you mean.
See what I mean?
How about the irrigation district?
Well, yeah, how about putting the boards back in? Putting the boards back in when the water master's taking them out.
Well, we include law.
That's vice versa.
Administration of law. Other governmental functions.
So I would say this is all inclusive.
Depends on whether you're down below or
up above.
Any governmental
function. The
how about school teachers striking?
Glad you mentioned that, Mr. Chairman.
Would that come under this?
It wasn't meant to come under this. As I recall, some states have a specific exemption for labor disputes.
Well, labor disputes, unless they're concerned with a governmental body, wouldn't be covered by this anyway. This only applies to the administration of law or legal functions. But school districts are creatures of the legislature. And a strike by school teachers.
Yes, there have been some strikes recently involving police departments and fire.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that this
intimidation. But I don't want to.
We're going to get a letter.
From Charlie Porter.
Yeah. But the one the means listed here are meant to be active acts rather than passive acts. I don't want to. You might have another situation of perhaps a picketing.
Yes, picketing or standing in front of the school door and telling the children to go back home.
But in any kind of legitimate labor dispute involving schools, police, or fire department, constitutionally, I don't think we can consider prohibiting picketing as a physical interference with obstacles.
Wouldn't that be physical?
Yes, picketing perhaps would be, but I don't think we could make that a crime.
Well, my question is, do you buy this?
By section 2,
suppose there are
section 2,
yeah. Kids not going to attend school.
Because what?
Suppose there are kids not going to go to school, and, you know.
That's verbal rather than physical, however.
Intimidation? Means intimidation. That's out of.
Oh. Well, there has to be a threat or something. If he just tells him not to come to school, there's no intimidation.
Well, how about the threat of ostracizing?
If you have a threat there, then you have intimidation.
Nobody's going to let you
make a crime in school.
Well, I think this does.
Or how about?
I think the. I didn't seem to mention Charlie. How about the threatening letter that we all get from constituents and so forth?
Or subscribers.
How about hindering the administration of the governmental function of running the buses?
Yeah.
You mean like?
By intimidation, that's for example.
You mean by approving the bad debt?
By one of the employers.
Now, Michigan, under their section 4505, which was used as a model on this section, does have, under their sub 2,
exception to the obstruction, impairment, or hindrance of any governmental function in connection with a labor dispute with the government. It's taken out of the application.
Labor dispute is just one of the myriad of possibilities in the word of intimidation.
Well, of course, but the problem you have is that when you, if you look at existing law here, some of the areas that are covered in our present statutes, if we're to attempt to try to combine and consolidate whenever possible to avoid unnecessary duplication and overlap on all these specific sections for a specific crime to handle one kind of situation, you've got to have language that is broad enough to encompass this kind of activity.
Well, but on the other side, you get the problem. Well, suppose I get letters from constituents saying, I'll never vote for you again. My group will not support you again. By the campaign contributions again, this type of thing. And that's intimidation.
But I assume that we write all these statutes with the Constitution in mind.
Well, I have a problem. On the other side, you get the person who says, now, why don't you prosecute me? Why don't you do something about this? The law says intimidation. Have you been intimidated?
Well, you have to show that you are intimidated before the statute is filed. Depends on who's an intimidator. You have to obstruct by intimidation, so on and so forth. Solicitation to intimidate or conspiracy to intimidate.
Well,
but I think that this actual statute, Roger, does it require that there actually has been some hindrance?
Yeah, you have to either obstruct, impair, or hinder. Right.
So the threat made, which does not change the official action, is not a crime.
Well, it would be under the incoherent crime.
I said a lot of those letters do change some of the official crime.
Well, because the subcommittee gave this such powerful consideration,
yeah, absolutely.
And in its wisdom decided that it was okay, I move we approve it, Mr. Chairman.
You heard the motion. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sandra Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
No.
Chandler?
Aye.
Frost?
No.
Jernstead?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
You're
abstaining
in this one.
Balmy?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
There's the advantage, Senator Burns. You've got to follow yourself.
Now
you here.
Wish to be recorded? I'll abstain until you get back. Shall we recess to 1:30?
Okay.
We haven't made any arrangements for... We have no arrangements have been made for lunch. Go wherever you damn please.
Why don't we recess?
Well, you know,
charge you all move.
Pardon?
How about recess until 1 and going home?
Can you all be back by 1?
I don't care.
1:15. Compromise. I'll get you
$7,500.
Dave?
You're on timing, huh?
Yes.
Okay. Are you reading it? I got it. It is covered by the resistant
arrest.
You know, we got through that homicide better than we thought, Bruce.
So oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's quite a contact, too.
You bet.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, if we go now, we're all right.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
desk here.
Aren't you going to lunch?
Yes, but I thought I could straighten this up because Connie will be back by then anyway. No, I probably mentioned it. He probably mentioned it to you, but Mr. Carson said that he wouldn't be able to attend the meeting next Thursday.
Yeah.
He's going to have to be out of town. And he really couldn't make it Friday. If he, you know, he's going to leave up from Washington Friday morning, and if he couldn't
this came up after we set the date.
Yes, the inner recorder's going. Oh, I think she wanted to turn it, let it maybe go to the end of that tape.
Oh.
And at least that's what I assumed. And
I'm sorry, I'm going to be up. Scott, put it away there. I'll